Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, for Colombia Calling, episode number 273. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode 272 with Mart Litwicki, Chicago-born, but Bogota faithful, let's say. He published the book Bogotano por Accidente, so English author writing in Spanish, and it was launched at the FILBO, the Feria Internacional del Libro in Bogota, so the international book fair here. It's been very successful so far. I hope to get my hands on a copy soon so I can have a read of it and share my thoughts down the line about this book. But this is episode 273. After our new segment with Adrian Alsema there in Medellin, the director of Columbia Reports, we'll be talking to Oliver Kaplan, who's the associate professor, the International School, the University of Denver, and he'll be talking about his book, Resisting War. And of course, this is all about nonviolent methods in Colombia, of course, taken in context internationally, but nonviolent methods of communities and social cohesion in order to face down the armed actors here in Colombia. It's a very, very interesting conversation coming up with Oliver Kaplan on segment three. And before I sign off and hand this over to Adrian Alsema, please remember that you can support Columbia Reports. That's our sister site there in Medellin, the most read news site on Colombia in English out of Colombia. So Adrian Alsema there, anything you can throw to help the independent news continue, any dollars you can throw that way are greatly received. And of course, just go to the website columbiareports.com, and up on the top left hand corner there is a banner that says support us, and that will take you to the Patreon site, and there you can pledge some money to ensure that the independent press continues to tell the real stories here in Colombia. But now I'm going to take a short break, and we'll be your next voice you'll hear, of course, is Adrian Alsema, providing you with this week's news from Colombia. And then we'll be back with Oliver Kaplan talking about Resisting War, his book, which will come out in Spanish around August this year. And there will be events in Bogota and around for this launch. So stay tuned, because I'm sure we'll have Oliver back on the show to talk about this event too. Thank you again. This is Richard McCall. Don't go away.
My name is Adrian Alsema, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for May 14, 2019. The outgoing ambassador of the United States in Colombia is under fire after the U.S. Embassy revoked the visas of some of Colombia's top judges. Ambassador Kevin Whitaker was already in a tight spot after he allegedly threatened an aid cut to Colombia unless Congress would limit the powers of the country's war crimes tribunal. Whitaker has been lobbying to maintain the U.S. privilege to request war criminals' extradition without evidence, but is increasingly opposed. Victim organizations and judicial experts for years have claimed that the U.S. policy to request the extradition of alleged drug traffickers has impeded justice for more than 200,000 war victims. The United Nations has slammed Colombia's authorities for their failure to adequately investigate the mass killing of social leaders. The UN Office for Human Rights, the OHCHR, urged authorities to make a significant effort to end the endemic impunity for the killing of human rights defenders and community leaders. The statement is a slap in the face of Prosecutor General Néstor Humberto Martínez, who praised the efficiency of justice in Colombia just last month. The human rights body warned that the violence continues to increase and could spike ahead of local elections in October. According to a renowned think tank, social leaders last year suffered more than 800 attacks, including 155 murders. A group of demobilized FARC guerrillas will represent Colombia at the International Rafting Championships in Australia later this month. This is the first time that members of the former rebel group represent their country at an international event. Electoral observers warned last week that this year's local elections are already more violent than those in 2015. The elections are not held until October. According to the Electoral Observation Mission, the MO, there have been 74 acts of aggression against local and regional politicians, including 10 homicides. Additionally, 52 social leaders who generally have great influence over communities in local elections were also killed, according to MO President Alejandro Barrios. Medellin will replace 1,500 yellow caps for electric taxis by 2022, the local government announced. The first 200 cars are expected to be providing taxi services before the end of the year. The green taxis will not be added to the existing fleet of approximately 19,300 taxis, but replace yellow caps that are older than 5 years. The abuse of power by authorities in Colombia has increased dramatically since President Iván Duque took office in August last year, according to political news website La Silla Vacía. The website talked to 57 sources in conflict areas and found there has been a significant increase in complaints about human rights abuses ever since the hard-right president took office. According to the news website, it was able to verify grave abuses of power, including soldiers opening fire on civilians, intimidation, arbitrary detentions, illegal searches, and false claims that civilians would be guerrillas. This is the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
This is episode 273 of the Colombia Calling podcast. This is me, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. My very special guest this week is Oliver Kaplan. He's the associate professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's a political scientist. His book came out a couple of years ago. It's called Resisting War, How Communities Protect Themselves. And, well, we're going to talk about this. And, of course, in the lead-in to his book being translated and published here in Spanish. So it's a very timely interview, of course, with everything that's going on in the countryside in Colombia and taking into account, the Jurisdicción Especial de Paz and what's going on with the assassinations of social and community leaders, the violence that seems to be rippling, not so much beneath the surface anymore under this administration. So we're just going to open up the conversation and say, well, welcome on Colombia Calling, Oliver.
Thanks so much, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I was very surprised that you got in touch with me. It's very flattering indeed. You know, someone of your stature and a political scientist, very well known. And so this opportunity to talk with you about your book, I'm a little bit humbled. But let's talk about it. Your book, Resisting War, it will come out in Spanish later this year, How Communities Protect Themselves. When I read this title, I immediately think of the peace community in Apartado, but you went there, but you studied other communities. You have other case studies for this. Tell us a little bit. Just give us a little bit of a background on this book and how it came about.
That's right. Well, first of all, it's an honor for me to be here. El honor es mío. So this book came about really, the nerdy academic story is I was a student and I was studying conflict. And all the theories and stories of conflict were all about victimization and how violence is used by armed actors to push civilians around. And at the same time, I saw a few news stories coming out of Colombia, especially about civilians that were not having that. They were rescuing their own kidnapped victims, they were protesting, they were pushing back against armed actors. And I thought, wow, this is so interesting, but how does this fit with these theories? Are they actually having an important effect on conflict or violence? And can we distinguish that from just the armed actors, the armed groups, letting them do what they want because they don't really care about the region or the community? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what got me interested in this topic and got me down to Colombia in the first place so many years ago. And so in initial work, I visited different peace communities, as some of them are called, or humanitarian spaces. They're also called by a number of names, basically communities that have taken an explicit policy of trying to stay out of the armed conflict, not taking sides, neutrality, things like that. And I also did some other background research and interviews to understand just the nature of conditions that campesinos and civilians here in Colombia experience and understand what threats they face, how they organize themselves, the decisions they make. And I realized that, that these so-called peace communities do a lot of interesting things, and I wanted to learn more about that. But I also felt like they were sort of the tip of the iceberg, that they actually represented a very cohesive type of social collective action, but that in Colombia and in other countries as well, they were much more nascent or lower level, more localized forms of collective action that I thought could also be really important. So different types of social cohesion, community organizations. And so I saw that although these were the tip of the iceberg, that this process of civilians trying to protect themselves was possibly a much more generalized phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And so when I started out, I visited a few communities, and what I was really trying to do in difference to what other scholars or news stories had already done was to really try to understand the mechanics of these communities. So how do they act? What strategies do they take? How do these strategies play out? What problems do they resolve? And how do they affect the strategies and the behaviors of these armed actors that would possibly use violence against them? And so that was really the impetus of it. And through that, I ended up first getting interested in a particular community in the department of Santander, which is called the Peasant Workers Association of the Carare River, or the Asociación de Trabajadores Campesinos del Carare, which is in the village of La India, they cross six different municipalities down there in southern Santander. But they had one of the longest local peace movements in the country. It was founded in 1987. And that I felt like in that case, they had enough history for me to trace some of their processes over time and across space and do some comparative analysis. And they also had some very interesting and clear procedures for how they conciliated threats and death threats and conflicts, and how they promoted certain social norms, how they dialogued with armed actors. And so I felt like that was a really good opportunity to try to do a bit more of a technical analysis of how these peace processes at the local level played out. From there, I went on to study several other communities around the country, in part to understand some of the other types of organizations that exist. And in particular, I came across the juntas de acción comunal, or the community action boards in English, basically village councils, and I looked at their role in some other communities.
Did you ever get down to San Juan de Losada then, on the border with Meta and Caquetá? I only ask because I was down there looking at the Junta de Acción Comunal.
You know, I did not get down there, but I did do some trips to Meta and to the zona part of the Zona de Despeje, and actually that's a section in the book where I kind of try to validate some of the things I saw in other departments and regions. And that region is interesting because, as you know, and probably a lot of the listeners know, that was under FARC control during the peace talks from 99 to 2002. And really, as they like to say, you know, a region about the size of Switzerland was ceded to the FARC to give them some security for the negotiations. And so there's a really interesting question about what happened in these really kind of dubious conditions for civilians, where they were, you know, in some ways possibly very controlled. Mm. And even in those conditions, you see some of these junta councils that basically were taking really important protective actions.
I find it fascinating. You've kind of taken the study, and we mentioned it at the beginning, you know, sort of seeing these communities in the heart of Colombia's conflict. We always see them as the victims, but you flipped it round in this circumstance. Certainly it's how, and I'll take this out of your summary, is how civilians can retain their autonomy of self-rule in the face of these armed groups. Now, you talked about this in this opening conversation, but how is it that they can? I mean, La India, let's say this town in Santander, which seems to be your one of your key focuses. What kind of population are we looking at there?
Well, in that region, and in many regions of Colombia, there's a lot of poverty. Mm. There's relatively low levels of education. In some cases, there's illiteracy, but I don't want to say that everyone's, I mean, certainly there is literacy, but isolated, few public goods, little contact with the state, a lot of neglect from the state. Mm. After years of conflict, and especially in the case of La India, but in a lot of these other communities, deep-seated fear among the population. And, you know, that's a real challenge for individuals to overcome, to come together and do something bigger, more collective.
But I know villages in various parts of the country, and certainly in the Montes de Maria, I'm up there a fair bit, and that was a while ago now, but, you know, I've met displaced families from there up here in Suba and other things, and the desire to go back, and actually they've gone back, but, you know, the village has been destroyed, and of course that fear remains, and of course these are places where incidents of great emotional, depth have occurred, and it stays in. I don't think we need to sound like a hippie in this world, but there's an energy that stays in these areas, and of course the fear of repetition. So, you know, let's say that the paramilitaries came through and did something awful, like in El Difícil or El Salado, and then the guerrillas came through in a different area. Was it Carare with the woodcutters that you write about there? How does a community get, and I don't know how to say this, but beyond that to defend themselves, because that fear is then instilled?
So it's a real question. How do you overcome fear? And I think you pointed out, you know, the exact problem, Richard, which is that these communities, they get stuck between armed groups, right, or armed actors. You know, if they were a benevolent state that were fully present, you know, probably most civilians would align with that state. In some cases, if it's a non-state group, civilians have aligned with that group because they see them as a source of protection. Mm-hmm. But the challenge occurs when, you know, that guarantee isn't there. If you hitch your wagon to one actor or another, the next day someone else could come through, and then the other group could come back. Mm-hmm. And so really the best thing to do is to try to maintain your autonomy, or to try to be independent from the conflict, from the armed actors, trying to not take side and really just stand up for the community itself. Mm. And the question, you know, that comes up then is, how do you do this?
Yeah.
And what I argue and what I've seen is you really need some pre-existing organization as the nucleus, as the basis for organizing.
Yeah.
And then upon organizing and having that capacity, having the social network, having the, in a sense, local bureaucratic capacity of the village to carry out actions to reach consensus, the communities can take different strategies to protect themselves and to, in some cases, interact with armed groups or to manage their own communities in terms of how they interact with the conflict. And so these strategies, the main ones I focus on, are actually the nonviolent strategies. And in some cases in Colombia and other countries, we see civilians taking up arms and weapons to defend themselves, so like a self-defense group. But that can be pretty problematic because, you know, most communities, they're not filled with fighters. They don't have lots of weapons. They're outgunned compared to these armed actors. And so the nonviolent strategies really offer them a way to preserve themselves, to hopefully minimize retaliation. And so I document a number of these different approaches that they use.
And one of them is that, you know, there was a meeting called where I guess some of the junta or the leaders of this community were going to go and address the FARC, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And it was going to be some 10 people. But they then went, you know, actually, it makes a lot more sense if we go as en masse. And I read this in the summaries and so on. So then 30 people turned up. The FARC weren't expecting this, and of course had to weigh up, you know, is this going to be a massacre rather than sort of, let's say, focused assassinations, disappearances? So that, I mean, I would see that as one of the tactics of that, nonviolent,
that,
let's say.
Yeah, I mean, that can be one of the tactics. I almost call it like mass people power, but sort of increasing the costs, for the armed actors. And one of the things I saw, and we can talk about this a little more, but I interviewed a lot of ex-combatants also about how they viewed different communities and what affected their calculus about how they treated communities and used violence. And one of the things that they mentioned, which is very consistent with this idea of the civilians coming together to protest in some way, is that they were worried about, you know, being seen, even if they were killing civilians as part of their operations, they were afraid of being seen or having a very big incident. And so they said, you know, when, you know, occasionally a selective killing, you know, you do that for deterrence or whatever, something, you know, horrific as that. But sometimes if there's a whole protesting community that's confronting you, it's a much different situation. And so it changes how you think about what the civilians want, what they're doing, what they're asking for, your reputation. So I think that one I explore a bit deeper in a blog post on political violence at a glance, something like, can civilians deter massacres? Yeah.
And coming back to your town, I'm going to say your town because you focus on it so much, and I know you want to go and visit again, La India. They've obviously, you know, they've come to accept you there as someone who's not only ethnographic, but you're there and you're talking to the people and watching the people. Now, there's one experience that you have in 2008, where a lady in the middle of the street collapses and she's screaming that her son's dying, what's being killed, and you watch the role of the community organization in action. Perhaps you share a bit with us.
Yeah, for the book, I mean, I'll just make a more general background statement. You know, the book is a bit of an academic book, but I really wanted to breathe life into it because I felt like you can't have a book. First of all, the literature tends to ignore civilians and civilian agency. And so if you're going to do a book on the agency of civilians and how they, you know, act for themselves and maintain their self-rule, you have to include that texture, in that soul, especially in a place like Colombia, which is so vibrant, so passionate, so emotional. I really felt like I had to include these anecdotes, really get the voices of the people I met in the book front and center, and make it, you know, a bit more accessible because there is some technical analysis, but there, I also wanted the stories to be in there, and so that you're not just looking at numbers. And so, you know, one of the things as I was kind of getting toward the final draft and I wanted to make it a bit more interesting was I thought about, you know, what stories during my field work really affected me and stuck with me. And I thought back to one of these early incidents when I was visiting this village of La India. And basically I saw a scene play out before my eyes. And, you know, as I was going back to write it up, I was thinking about it. It had been a few years prior, and I thought, you know, this is so unbelievable. Yeah. Did I even really remember this? Yeah. Did this really happen? And it seems, the images seem so clear, but I was like, did I read about this? And I was like, no, this is actually something I saw. I went back and I checked my notes. And basically what I saw was in some ways very, very tragic, but also a real act of compassion. And so a woman, you know, I was sitting one morning, you know, shooting the breeze with one of my contacts on their porch. And all of a sudden, this woman came out in the street just wailing and kind of dropped to her knees. I mean, I remember this so clearly. And you know, I was, you know, in the book, I also recognize a lot of my own positionality and who I am. And, you know, I'm a foreigner in this village. People have taken me in, but I don't understand everything that's going on there. And so I tried to convey that, you know, I see this happening, and it's just, you know, in the middle of rural Colombia, you see something like this happen, you don't know what to think. Is there a security issue? Am I safe? You know, are the people here around me safe? What's happening? You know, and I saw basically how this community responded. All of a sudden, you know, basically everybody who was on the street just came to surround this woman and try to help her, give her support. You know, just seeing that happen, the man that I was sitting with ran out to her as well. You know, and this was probably 5-10 minutes, finally, the man came back and said, you know, well, I said, well, what happened? What's going on? You know, like, what's the situation here? And I guess the woman had said that her son had been shot on a nearby farm, possibly by a criminal band at that point. It wasn't exactly clear. And what happened next was even more fascinating, because I had, you know, heard about the community procedures to deal with acts of violence. And I saw at the time who I was the vice president of this association. He, you know, went and checked what was happening, immediately jumped on a motorbike and went to get help for this woman. You know, this isn't police, this isn't the mayor, this is just the association, you know, implementing its daily procedures to deal with this kind of thing. And, you know, and that really was like, you know what, what better way to explain what's happening and what they have to deal with and how they confront it than what I saw, you know, in person.
You're bridging, you know, academia and nonfiction, which of course makes the book a more attractive option to those out there who are ready to, you know, wade through academia and maybe every, you know, lots of references to Calibas.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a way of kind of structuring some of these stories, and then also using the stories to kind of breathe life into the theory and the results, you know. So
dare I ask, what was the outcome? The gentleman, the man, had been shot in the leg, I believe.
You know, I didn't end up hearing what had happened from that, and so I probably should. Yeah, I mean, maybe I should try to follow up. I think they went and got help. I think they were going to try to arrest the perpetrators, but it was something that had sort of took longer than I was able to find out. So
I see this, you know, these issues. Now, one question that's just, it's come to me in this, and you'll probably not enjoy it. I mentioned earlier that I was down in San Juan de Losada, and I'm watching, you know, different community groups, and they had meetings and so on. And I've since talked to people who are in the UN base down there, you know, peace monitors and so on. And they referred directly, without me having said it, to one of these community groups, the one who had taken us in and put us up, as being so heavily infiltrated by the FARC. Did you find this in the community groups that you... Because the government here will have you believe that every single group is infiltrated. You know, but has this been something in your experience?
Well, I don't want to speak about any particular community
don't mention that.
The whole point of the book is to fight against stigmatization of civilians, so that civilians aren't painted with a broad brush as being, you know, on one side of the conflict or the other.
Yeah.
But certainly this happens to different degrees in Colombia and in other countries and communities. And, you know, I think part of it's only natural.
Yeah.
You know, if there's an armed actor that is exercising a lot of control, at least publicly and even maybe, you know, in reality, you know, community members are going to maintain some allegiances with certain armed actors.
Whoever's
there. Yeah. Yeah, it could be paramilitaries, could be guerrillas, could be, in some cases, the state obviously is there, and there's a stronger allegiance. And I think the interesting thing about that is that, you know, in some cases, even if there is some type of allegiance, whether you know formal, informal, or affinity. You know, the community structures themselves, even in those cases, maintain some independence. They're a mechanism for accountability. They push back against those armed actors so that there's still a respect. They're still, you know, following rules. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that structure is important because that armed group isn't going to be there all the time necessarily. And so if the power relations change, a different group comes in, well, that structure that's there is still advocating on behalf of the civilians, and they're going to adapt to those new conditions. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, the way that I've conceived of this in terms of the policy implications is really that, you know, the communities, their job is to stand up for themselves. Mm-hmm. It's if the state wants a better relationship with those communities, it's up to the state to come in and provide a credible, consistent offer of support. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, I think, you know, you see better relationships, you see more public goods, you see more security, but it has to be an accountable relationship. I mean, if you think about state building in that kind of question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, big problem that with state presence in these areas, definitely. Yeah. One thing, again, you mentioned about your interviews in a purely social science sort of framework. You wrote down that your interviews are a careful construction of counterfactual scenarios of what would have happened, what the armed groups would have done had the civilians not used a given strategy. So I assume you're sitting down with the local, let's say, people and so on, and you're asking them, had you not done this, what do you expect that the guerrillas, paramilitaries, armed groups would have done? This must have revealed some fascinating insights into what these people have lived.
Yeah, I mean, this was kind of the real brain twister of the project, trying to figure out, well, you know, how can we assess this impact of civilian actions, kind of taking everything else constant in a way. And I really tried to do this in two different ways. The book does have some statistical work, and basically through that, I try to do some controlled tests to try to identify, you know, what's the marginal effect of these community, the presence of these community organizations, taking into account different conflict dynamics, development issues. And you see that, you know, the more organization in general, there's less violence suffered across these communities. And so, in short, the argument is that more organization, it lets you take certain nonviolent strategies. And as a result, the armed actors behave differently. Either they commit less violence or they change what they're doing, whatever that is. And so then in interviews, it was a totally different question about how to understand the strategic aspect. And so I interviewed a lot of the civilians and said, well, why did you do XYZ or not do XYZ? Why did you take a certain action? Why didn't you? Mm. What was the result, or what do you think would have been the result? So some speculation there. And then I think perhaps even more interestingly, I interviewed a lot of ex-combatants from FARC, ELN, paramilitary groups, especially ones around the regions that I studied, and I focused on a few small towns in Cundinamarca. I also did a little bit of work in Caldas, and then villages in Santander. And a few really interesting quotes came out. The first one that I really find fascinating and like to mention is I was interviewing a former FARC mid-level commander, mm-hmm. and asking him, well, you know, how do you view, you know, how does your view change between a community that's kind of organized and maybe pushing back against you versus just a single individual or sort of a less organized community? And he responded with a phrase that was either from Shakespeare or Aristotle. And of course, this was an education for me. I did not know this. But he said, una sola golondrina no hace verano. Or in English, yeah. A single swallow doesn't make a summer. And I said, you know, and I was kind of perplexed by this first when he said it in Spanish, and then as I thought about it, and I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, you know, a single swallow doesn't make a summer. If you see a single individual or a single swallow, it's not really enough to change your mind. Mm-hmm. But if you see a flock of swallows, you know, a whole group of people taking a concerted action, it changes how you think about the situation. You can't do what you were doing before, and we had to adapt. And so for me, that sort of really spoke to the counterfactual of, like, you know, if you have organized opposition versus not, how do they adapt? And, you know, I heard a similar story, which is really fascinating in some ways across the book, the consistency across armed groups and across even the other countries I look at, you see very similar quotes. And one of the quotes that really speaks to that example from the FARC is, I was able to access some of the archives of the Peasant Workers Association, the ATCC. And the fascinating, really fascinating thing about that community is they took verbatim, word for word notes of all the dialogues that they ended up having with the armed actors, with the military, with members, you know, their own internal meetings. And I was able to access some of these notes and reconstruct, kind of be like a fly on the wall for some of these meetings. And there was one meeting in particular in the early 2000s. They were meeting with a paramilitary subcommander and some of the neighboring villages nearby that were actually not part of their kind of peace community, if you will, a bit more affected by the conflict. And the fascinating thing is a woman from one of these neighbor communities essentially in the meeting stands up and says, you know, how come we can't have the type of respect and autonomy that the ATCC next door, the peasant workers, have? And basically, I mean, to paraphrase, you know, he said, well, the paramilitary commander responds, well, if it's just one or two people, if it's the whole town that rises up in protests, essentially, we will respect the decision. But if it's only one or two people that are voicing opposition, we're going to stay here and we're going to continue to exercise control. And so there, you know, you really get to the almost the psychology of these armed actors and how they're responding to the community efforts.
It's so hard to organize a community, I would say, that again has lived or has seen such violence. Yeah. Maybe that, yeah, again, that fear. Have there, if I ask this as we're winding down, have there been real failures of in the attempts to create, let's say, peace communities where it's just collapsed totally, or the armed forces have said, no, we're not respecting this, not the armed forces, the armed actors, that we're not respecting this. Are there examples in your book of this?
There are some examples of failure, certainly, and I mean in different ways. I'd first say, just as a background point on the question of fear, you know, it's really hard to organize in the midst of fear.
Yeah.
And so that's why that kind of pre-existing social structure and network and organization is so important. But then, you know, even with that and even having organized, it's really difficult to maintain these peace movements, and sometimes they are not convenient for the armed actors. And so they do face a lot of repression, oppression of different forms. And, you know, I don't want to sort of, you know, point fingers, and I think it's a bit of a subjective question about what constitutes a success or a failure. But, you know, we can think about certainly different examples and episodes. San Jose Apartado is one of the most famous peace communities really in the world, and they did not have an easy go of things. I mean, it's a credit to them that they persisted. It's really amazing. They suffered a lot during their times. They were forcibly displaced. They tried to return. They continued to suffer different episodes of violence and massacres. They've still persisted, but they continue to face these threats. The case of the ATCC, as far as I can determine, the peasant workers group in La India, they overall saw some success for about a 10-year period in the 90s. They basically saw zero victimization, zero killing, but then victimization returned. And I analyzed that. How come they were so successful? And then as conflict dynamics changed, they had more of a challenge fighting violence. And so there were some changes in the approaches of the armed actors. The community had to reestablish certain social norms, things like that. And so that, you know, in some ways, it's a, you know, it's a constant struggle. You know, one of the key quotes that sticks in my mind is that a lot of the civilians will say, especially in the peace communities, that peace is an everyday affair. You know, it's not something you can't take your eye off the ball. You know, maintaining peace requires constant effort, vigilance, cooperation, dialogue. And, you know, I think that lesson itself, I think is really a valuable, more general lesson for Colombia and for the world. I mean, especially today in Colombia, you know, we're seeing this peace process implementation, it's in jeopardy. And, you know, I think the lesson that these peace communities and local actors have for all Colombians is that, hey, you know, if you want peace, you have to fight for it. And it has to be an everyday effort until you have some security of that peace. And, you know, I think as an outside observer, you know, following the news, following what's happening in Colombia, in some ways, it's really been gratifying to see the people, you know, in Colombia, in the cities and elsewhere. They come out and they've been fighting for the peace agreement, you know, the peace marches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these happened throughout the conflict and they're happening now during the peace process. You know, they're coming out to fight for the agreement after the plebiscite failed. They're coming out to fight for the HEP to make sure that, you know, the terms of the agreement stay. And so, you know, I think there actually is this connection from the local philosophy that was developed to what we see today in trying to maintain the peace process.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say that's the situation now, with the only issue that I really worries me, of course, is these assassinations of local and community leaders that just does not end. They're quite, and these are messages. These are targeted people. These are messages. I don't know how you see this from an academic standpoint, and of course, having known, I'm sure, people who are at threat.
Yeah, this is a really difficult issue. A number of people I keep in touch with have been threatened, and obviously, a lot of the people that I've interviewed themselves have been victims, or their family members have been targeted, things like that. And it's a sad thing to see recurring. Mm-hmm. This type of targeted violence is actually one of the main topics of the book, the thinking about how these civilians and communities cope with and deal with this challenge. One of the ways is a lot of these self-protection mechanisms. So I kind of talked about the protest already. Mm-hmm. One of the other ways is managing information about threats and trying to reconcile them. Another way is managing community members so that they don't take sides with armed actors and seed divisions within communities. The protest is one of them. I'll just say that within the book, I documented very carefully a prior wave of killings of community leaders from the mid-90s to the 2000s, especially targeted against the leaders of the junta councils, because I wanted to understand what was the interaction between the targeting of leaders and the capacity of these councils to continue acting. And in short, I saw that as the targeting spiked along with the patterns of the conflict around the year 2000, the effects, the protective effects of these junta councils was a bit weakened. Mm-hmm. And so I think today, you know, when it's especially targeted violence, it's a much more difficult problem to deal with. If it's sort of more the general nature of conflict and seeding divisions, that's something that communities maybe can overcome. That said, you know, I think these peace communities in particular, they have a lot of lessons for how to cope with this violence. And I'll first say that, you know, the violence that's being experienced, it really is the first and foremost the responsibility of the state to address and to provide protection, to secure areas, you know, to work toward destigmatization of social activism. But, you know, in cases where the state falls short or where it doesn't reach, you know, these communities, you know, we really do need to make sure that they have the skills and tools to, when necessary, protect themselves, protect their leaders. And these communities, especially the peace communities, have, you know, really creatively innovated different protective approaches to protect their leaders, to protect people under threat, to get them out of areas of violence, to, you know, temporarily displace them, to hide them, to, you know, claim that, you know, well, everybody's a social leader here, so if you're gonna, you know, you can't just target one person because we're a much stronger movement than that. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot of lessons, you know, if we look to these communities and look to some of the strategies that I document, mm-hmm. They really do pertain for this post-peace agreement period and the nature of violence. So So I think, you know, there are a lot of lessons that, unfortunately, I think Colombia and other countries have had to learn and relearn. But I think, you know, in some ways, getting better at it.
Well, listen, thank you. I think we could probably talk for hours. And all I have to do is sort of nudge you and then a fantastic amount of information. So, I mean, thank you for coming on and Colombia Calling, and thank you for explaining this situation so thoroughly and accessibly for all of my audience. It's been really interesting. So everyone out there, if you're interested, definitely get hold of Oliver Kaplan's book, Resisting War, How Communities Protect Themselves. And of course, I think you can put it into international context. I think international contexts are, of course, brought into the book. It will be out in Spanish later this year. There will probably be events, hopefully in August, for around the launch in Spanish. Let me just say again that to Oliver Kaplan is the Associate Professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's a political scientist, and he's been here for episode 273 here in Bogota. Oliver, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Richard. Really great questions, and look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you again. That's us for this week. We'll be back next week. We're changing tack a little bit, have a different style of interview coming up. But thank you again for listening, and bye-bye.